Hello, campus cronies. Welcome back to Campus Crime Chronicles. I'm your host, Dr. Nicole Turner, higher education professional and true crime addict. In every episode of this podcast, I take a deep dive into some sort of true crime that occurred on a school campus or a crime that's associated with a college or university in some way. For each episode, I rate the seriousness of the crime from 1 to 5 on my serious crime scale, with 1 being completely not serious, possibly even a little humorous from time to time, to 5 being very serious. This episode is rated a 5. One of the most critical moments in any dating or domestic violence situation is when the victim tries to leave or break off the relationship. Unfortunately, for 20-year-old college student Alicia Wiley, her exit from the relationship with her long-term boyfriend resulted in the ultimate betrayal, her murder. This episode is titled, When She Tried to Leave. So without further ado, let's get started. Marie Wiley was born on November 24, 1992. Her mother, Corinna Martin, recalled how Alicia always had a mind of her own, and her birth was no different. Corinna said, quote, Alicia was determined to come into this world, and when I was 8 months pregnant, Alicia finally decided she couldn't wait no more. She was so tiny, like she fit in the palm of my hand, end quote. Alicia was born into a family of women, as she was the third daughter of a single mother. But since her older sisters couldn't pronounce Alicia, she was quickly given the nickname Lily, which stuck. Soon, all of her closest friends and family were calling her Lily. Growing up in a close-knit family in Connecticut, Alicia and her sisters formed strong bonds with one another, but Alicia and her sister Shahara's became particularly close. On an episode of Oxygen's Final Moments, Shahara's described how Alicia looked up to her. She said, quote, Alicia was the type that would, if she saw me liking something, she would try it out, end quote. Shahara has also said that they especially enjoyed shopping and picking out new outfits together. She said, quote, we loved fashion. We loved dressing up. That's something that we bonded on, glamming up. But we were there for each other. We were close, end quote. After giving birth to Alicia, Corinna would go on to have another daughter and one son, and she pushed all 5 of her children toward education and being able to stand on their own 2 feet. As a result of this, Alicia became a brilliant, dedicated student, and she eventually earned herself a presidential scholarship to Eastern Connecticut State University in Willimantic, Connecticut. It was an impressive scholarship that covered tuition, room, and board. Her mom said, quote, Alicia's drive was unstoppable. I was in awe of it. We were ecstatic for her to be a young Black woman and see that people were recognizing her for the content of her character and her exceptional mind. You know, that's huge. That's huge. End quote. Once in college, Alicia thrived, both in academics and her social life. According to one source, she majored in psychology and minored in biology, but another source says she was a sociology major. Either way, she was a very dedicated, driven student. As for extracurricular activities, Alicia was a member of FEMALES, a student organization that promotes sisterhood, leadership, and unity, according to the ECSU website. Her sister, Shahara's, recalled how Alicia not only welcomed her independence while being in college, but she embraced it and truly enjoyed it. Shahara said, quote, she loved being on her own. She didn't have anybody to answer to. I mean, she enjoyed her freedom, end quote. During the late spring semester of 2013, 20-year-old Alicia was a sophomore at ECSU and she was preparing for her final exams. But on Saturday, April 20th, things took an unexpected turn when Alicia went missing and stopped all contact with her best friend. That day, she was texting with her best friend from college, Sade Burke, just as she normally did. Sade said it wasn't uncommon for them to text all day, every day. So at first, this was just another normal day for them. They started texting around noon while Alicia was waiting on a bench outside of her residence hall for her boyfriend, Jermaine Richards, to pick her up. Now, Richards was older than Alicia by several years, like 10 years, but the two had been dating since she was in high school. Shaharaz recalled how Alicia and Richards initially met. Shaharaz said, quote, "When she was a junior in high school, she was like, 'Hey, I started talking to this guy.' That guy was Jermaine. Alicia told me that she was walking home from school one day and he'd seen her and approached her in a car. That's how they met," end quote. Anyway, Sade said the text from Alicia stopped after Richards picked her up that day on April 20th. Then Sade didn't get another text from Alicia until much later that night at around 11 p.m. In those texts, Alicia told Sade that Richards had dropped her off and that she was walking back to Sade's room and needed a drink. Naturally, Sade was like, "Yeah, let's hang." So she waited up for her friend to arrive. And she waited and waited, but Alicia never showed. Sade said she tried texting but received no replies, and she even tried calling Alicia twice, but again, no response. While this bothered Sade, I mean, how would it not? She said she wasn't necessarily worried. She knew her friend and how independent she was, so she shrugged it off. Besides, Alicia was a good student, so she'd figured she'd see her in class on Monday and the two could catch up then. Unfortunately, though, Sade was wrong. She said, quote, "Monday comes, she's not there, not in class, anything. So now, I'm not going to lie. I'm really freaking out," end quote. The next day, on Tuesday, April 23rd, Sade approached one of their professors and asked if he'd seen Alicia. He had not, but he asked Sade if that was normal behavior for Alicia. You know, for her to go completely silent on communication and skip class. When Sade informed the professor that it wasn't like Alicia at all, he sprung into action and checked to see if she had attended any other classes that week. He soon discovered that Alicia hadn't been to class at all since the week before, which sparked university officials to alert campus police. Sade said, quote, "Then, later that day, I get a call from campus police letting me know that she was nowhere to be found and she's been missing for a few days. My heart dropped because that's when I realized that this was no longer, like, me just being in my head. This was for real," end quote. Later that day, ECSU police reached out to law enforcement in New Haven, Alicia's hometown, for assistance. New Haven police were tasked with stopping by Alicia's mother's house to do a wellness check and see if she could locate Alicia. Corinna, however, was just as perplexed as they were. She said as far as she knew, her daughter was back on campus at ECSU. That's when the unthinkable happened, and Alicia was officially reported missing. As Corinna spoke to police, though, and provided them all the information she possibly could about her daughter, she quickly informed them that something must be wrong, because Alicia, she wouldn't just walk away or disappear on her own. Corinna said, quote, "It took me about 45 minutes to convince the officer that Alicia, she's not missing. She didn't walk away from her life. She's not missing. Somebody has her," end quote. After this, Connecticut State Police became involved in the case, which was assigned to lead investigator Sergeant Forrest Ruddy. While police in New Haven were getting information from Corinna, Sergeant Ruddy and his team began interviewing people on campus back in Willimantic. They started with her roommates and her friends and then expanded to her classmates and professors. But nobody could provide helpful information. Sergeant Ruddy said, quote, "Everyone was saying the same thing. We haven't heard from her in days. So that was a little more alarming, and I get more detectives on the scene," end quote. As investigators began tracking Alicia's movements before she went missing, including checking surveillance cameras on campus, it didn't take them long to connect the dots. Her long-term boyfriend, Jermaine Richards, was the last person to see her, which was Saturday when he picked her up from campus. Surveillance footage from Alicia's residence hall showed Richards' black Nissan Altima pulling up, and Alicia could be seen getting into the passenger side at around noon that day. Now, they just needed to talk to Richards. According to the episode of Final Moments, Alicia's family reached out to Richards and asked him to go to the police station to assist them with their investigation. You know, since he was the last person known to actually see her. He agreed and went to talk to police. When he showed up, he told investigators that after picking her up on campus, the two drove an hour and a half to Bridgeport, Connecticut, where they spent an uneventful day at his mother's house. Then, he said, he drove her back to Willimantic that night and dropped her off shortly before 11 p.m. at the Dairy Queen, which was about two blocks away from the main campus gate. Now, unless she just insisted on getting her steps in, I have no idea why this fool would think it was okay to drop his 20-year-old girlfriend off at a fast food restaurant and make her walk, in the dark, late at night, by herself, two full blocks to campus. Does that make a lick of sense to you? Because it doesn't to me. But I digress. Anyway, dude said he hadn't heard from Alicia since that night when he dropped her off. And yes, police were just as skeptical as you and I both are right now, and they looked into Jermaine Richards' background. He didn't have much of a criminal history, but they did learn he was in the nursing field and had medical training. So keep that tidbit of information in your back pocket for later. Anyway, the next thing on their list was to try and verify Richards' story. First, they spoke to his mother, who confirmed that he and Alicia had been at her house on April 20th, and they appeared to be getting along well. Nothing seemed off or wrong to her. They also searched Richards' Nissan Altima for any clues or evidence of a struggle or a fight, but investigators found nothing. Then they subpoenaed both Richards' and Alicia's cell phone records to track their movements. If Richards and Alicia were together the whole day on Saturday, April 20th, their phone pings should prove it. Now, for some reason, they gained instant access to Richards' phone records, but they had to wait a while for Alicia's. Regardless, his phone records seemed to back up his story. After he supposedly dropped Alicia off in Willimantic at the Dairy Queen, he made a phone call at around 11 p.m., which bounced off a tower in Willimantic. Then he continued to talk on the phone, on that same phone call, for about 45 minutes, nearly all the way back to Bridgeport. Investigators said his phone was making contact with towers in between the two cities the whole time, which was a distance of about 75 miles. So, since Jermaine Richards' account of the day seemed to check out, investigators moved on to other theories of what might have happened to her. At least for now. I mean, Richards wasn't completely off their suspect list, but they did need to continue working and trying to find Alicia. So, while they waited for access to her phone records, they theorized that, perhaps, Alicia might have been abducted or targeted by a sex offender in the area, especially if she was walking by herself that late at night. After checking the sex offender registry, they generated a list of possible suspects. But here's the thing. Every single person on the registry had a solid alibi for the night of April 20th, so that sent police back to square one, and right back to Jermaine Richards. You see, by this time, Alicia's cell phone records had finally been released. Sergeant Ruddy said, quote, "Working with the cell phone towers and triangulation where the phones would plot, it kind of gave us almost like a breadcrumb of where her activities were. In addition to those locations, we also had text messages back and forth with Alicia and her friends and her family. There was text messages from Alicia's phone, and it's bouncing off the towers that are right around the university," end quote. Based on the text messages with her family and friends, police began putting more of a story together. In other words, the picture was becoming clearer. They learned that Alicia was thinking about breaking up with Jermaine Richards, something her text from that night revealed. And apparently, she did it that very night because she texted Sade and told her so. You see, when she was texting with Sade and telling her that she wanted to hang out and needed a drink, she also said she wanted to be single and that she was officially done with Jermaine. While Sade wasn't overly surprised because she had felt the breakup coming, she was shocked that it happened so suddenly. Sade said, quote, "The text wasn't odd to me because I feel like I knew Alicia was going to break up with Jermaine soon. I just didn't know when. What caught my surprise was not the fact she actually was breaking up with him, just that she did it sooner than I expected," end quote. Sade went on to explain that Alicia's and Richards' relationship began to change when Alicia got to college and started meeting other guys her own age. Sade said, quote, And of course, they're more studious and they're upstanding guys. You know what I mean? They're in college. Jermaine is somewhere else. So I feel like that opened her eyes a little bit more to the world. There's more to life than just Jermaine. I feel like she started to have like a self-realization moment. And over time, I noticed that she was more open to dating or talking to other guys, and that's what let me know. Okay, Jermaine's going to be out of the picture pretty soon. I think she just said she was just like over it, like her patience is just through with him. End quote. Alicia's last communication was the text to Sade, which came in at 11:03 p.m., and her phone had been bouncing off towers around the university in Willimantic. But shortly after this, her phone suddenly stopped pinging. It went dead silent and was nowhere to be found. But as they were sorting through all of Alicia's text messages, investigators noticed another series of texts from that same day that piqued their interest. Alicia was texting with a former boyfriend, which began at 4:43 p.m. on April 20th. Sergeant Ruddy said she had made arrangements to see him, the former boyfriend, later that same night. She had asked him what time he was getting off work and suggested that he could come to her dorm that night afterward. Naturally, police tracked this guy down and, according to the episode of Final Moments, he was cooperative and showed real genuine concern. Sergeant Ruddy said that he really wanted to help and he did just that. He was open with investigators and told them the text messages between him and Alicia stopped sometime late Saturday afternoon and he had not heard from her since. Investigators also checked his alibi, and the ex-boyfriend had been at work in New Haven right up until about 11 p.m. So, the only thing left for investigators to do was look closer at Alicia's long-term boyfriend, Jermaine Richards. They soon realized that, beyond basic information, her friends and family knew very little information about him. Essentially, she kept her relationship with Richards private and separate from her everyday life at school and with family. He was kind of like her big secret. Shaharis described Alicia's relationship with Richards. She said, quote, "She was in another world when he came around. It was like nobody else existed. She was in love with him," end quote. But the little she did share with her friends and family was alarming, to say the least. Shaharis, who was not only her sister but also her closest ally and confidant, revealed something that happened about a month before Alicia disappeared. Shaharis explained that Alicia had called her late at night and asked Shaharis to come pick her up. Alicia was with Richards and several other people, but she was hiding in the bathroom and whispering on the phone. Shaharis said, quote, "She was like, I'm in one of the bathrooms. I'm at one of his client's house with Jermaine, and I don't want to be here," end quote. So, sometime after midnight, Shaharis and her boyfriend drove 45 minutes to pick up Alicia. When she came out of the house, Shahara said she was nervous and visibly upset and fearful. On the drive back home, Shahara prodded Alicia on what happened. Although reluctant, Alicia revealed some disturbing information. She told Shahara that she was trying to talk to Richards and he suddenly got mad. He then put her on the bed and tried to smother her and choke her. Naturally, Shaharis was incredibly concerned for her younger sister, but she just allowed the space for Alicia to talk and get it out, which was something she rarely did. Then, once they arrived back to Shaharis' house that night, they continued talking. Shaharis explained, quote, "She said, I want you to know, this isn't the first time this happened. And I was like, what do you mean? And she was like, this isn't the first time that he's put his hands on me. And I said, well, you don't have to tell me everything. You don't have to if you don't want to, but I'm here for you." And she just got up and walked back into the living room and we went to sleep. End quote. Still, Alicia had a hard time pulling herself away from Richards. And although Shaharis was worried for her sister, she knew she had to walk a fine line between being there for her and saying something that would offend Alicia and cause her to shut down. Shaharis said, quote, "I didn't want to lose her to me running my mouth. Like, I didn't want her to think, okay, now I told her, and now she's going to go tell everybody else, and then now I'm just going to go back to the same situation, because who else can I trust? So I kept it. What she told me, I kept until one day she was gone." After hearing this information, the motive was becoming clearer to investigators. They now believed that Alicia tried to officially break it off with Jermaine Richards that day, but that he did not take it well. They believed it might have triggered a violent reaction from Richards, which meant it was more important than ever to find Alicia. Because at this point, she was still missing and it wasn't looking good. When they reached out to Richards for a second time, though, and asked him to come to the station once again for additional questioning, he refused. Sergeant Ruddy said, quote, "So that was very concerning to us because here we think, okay, you're the boyfriend. You should show some type of concern for her safety and assist the police. So that raised some red flags with us," end quote. When Richards decided not to cooperate, police tried to put some pressure on him by holding a press conference with the family. Specifically, they wanted Alicia's mom, Corinna, to address Jermaine Richards indirectly without mentioning his name with the help of the media. During the press conference, Corinna delivered a heartfelt plea through her tears. She said, quote, "We need for anybody who knows something, and I know there's someone out here who does, to come forward. Please help us bring our loved one, my baby, home," end quote. Unfortunately, the press conference generated no results, and Richards didn't budge. But that didn't stop law enforcement and Alicia's family from organizing multiple searches for Alicia. They searched all over the state of Connecticut, but more meticulously along the route Richards drove that night from Willimantic to Bridgeport. As the searches continued, days turned to weeks before finally, on May 17, 2013, 27 days after Alicia went missing, Sergeant Ruddy was summoned to a location near Bridgeport. According to the reporting of Daniel Tepfer for the Connecticut Post, a search party discovered some partial human remains in a wooded area at the end of Quarry Road in Trumbull, Connecticut. The location was only a mile and a half from Richards' home. Here's the thing, though. Not to be too graphic, but I said partial remains because all that was found was an arm and a leg that were both in a substantial state of decomposition. And DNA soon confirmed that the body parts belonged to Alicia. Now, the investigation went from a missing persons to a homicide case. State's attorney, Joseph T. Corradino, said, quote, "The medical examiner determined that those remains had been disarticulated by an edged instrument. It wasn't a saw. It wasn't an axe. It was a knife. That's a skill set that one who knows human anatomy would have to have." Jermaine Richards completed the course of study prescribed for a licensed practical nurse. Among the things that he needed to know was human anatomy, end quote. After re-examining Richards' alibi, investigators quickly determined that her remains being found near Bridgeport completely imploded his story about taking Alicia back to Willimantic that night. The only added twist was that somebody was texting Sade about going to her dorm and needing a drink, and that she had called it quits with Jermaine. But to this day, investigators have no idea who actually sent the texts, but they are certain it was not Alicia. On May 17, 2013, after discovering Alicia's partial remains, police issued a warrant for Jermaine Richards' arrest on the same day. He was officially charged with murder in the first degree and kidnapping. The thing is, though, the prosecution had a daunting challenge in court proving that Richards was responsible. And securing a conviction would take not once, not twice, but three times before a jury found him guilty. During the first two trials, the jury deadlocked. You see, there was no murder weapon. They never found the knife used to dismember Alicia. And there were no bloodstains or DNA evidence. There was just no concrete evidence that might normally be found at a murder scene. So, State's Attorney Corradino said, he was genuinely concerned that Jermaine Richards was going to get away with the crime. But as they say, the third time's a charm. And from what I gather, based on my research and source materials, the prosecution changed its strategy during the third trial to illuminate the dating and domestic violence perspective. Corradino said, quote, "Our focus was on the issue of domestic violence. It was important for the jury to consider what was happening in that relationship," end quote. The prosecution focused on the fact that it's not easy to leave or get out. When a person is involved in a domestic violence relationship, specifically as the victim, they don't truly understand the dynamics. Because it's not just physical, it's also emotional and psychological. During the last trial, Alicia's friends and family testified that Richard was jealous and possessive and that he had been physically violent with her. According to the Connecticut Post, the prosecutor told the judge, quote, "Alicia Wiley wanted to end an abusive relationship, and when she began to break away, he killed her. This isn't just a murder, it's monstrous. They, the victim's family, don't even have a body to bury. They only have an arm and a leg," end quote. Finally, the jury came back with a guilty verdict in March of 2018, 5 years after Alicia's life was so tragically and violently taken. As soon as they announced the verdict, Shahara said she felt instant relief. She said, quote, "It was like a breath of fresh air. It was just, thank God, the entire time. Like, I was just so happy. I prayed so hard, so much. Like, that's all I could do was be happy. Like, finally, finally," end quote. When it was time for Karina, Alicia's mom, to deliver a victim impact statement to the court, she chose to speak about her daughter rather than direct her anger or hurt toward Richards. Clutching a tissue to wipe her tears, Karina said, quote, "It was a difficult but short birth. She was one of the most beautiful and perfect children. She overcame a lot of adversity to become a beautiful and brilliant young woman. 27 and a half days we searched and searched, early in the morning, late at night, neighborhood after neighborhood. My heart broke in me when the remains of my child were confirmed. My child, my child. Anytime I hear of any bones being found anywhere, my heart gets ripped out because I don't know if that's going to be another part of her," end quote. When it was Richard's turn to address the court, he stood, placed his hand over his heart, and began reciting biblical scripture, specifically Psalm 91. As he began, saying, "Whoever dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty," it caused an outburst from Alicia's stepfather, John Rich. He shouted, quote, "All that shit you said, you need to rot in hell. You showed no remorse," end quote. After demanding order in the court, the judge handed 35-year-old Jermaine Richards the maximum sentence of 60 years in prison without the possibility of parole. The judge said, quote, "Sir, by your actions, you have forfeited your right to walk amongst free men and women," end quote. Since Alicia's tragic death, Karina has made it her mission to bring awareness to domestic violence. Sighing through tears, she said, quote, "We all need to understand that the most fatal time for anyone getting out of a domestically abusive relationship is the leaving. I didn't teach my girls that. I didn't know," end quote. Karina has started a nonprofit organization called MOVE, or Mothers of Victims Equality, which brings awareness to domestic violence and offers support and resources to both victims and families. You see, not only did Karina lose Alicia to domestic violence, but in a tragic turn of events, she also lost her oldest daughter and her 9-year-old granddaughter to a domestic violence incident as well in 2017, just 4 years after Alicia was murdered. Ever since, Karina has been committed to keeping her daughter's and her granddaughter's memory alive and has worked to put a stop to domestic violence. To the perpetrators who took her family's lives, Karina said, quote, "What you thought you took and what you thought you silenced only made them louder, because my voice is theirs now," end quote. If you or someone you know has been a victim of dating or domestic violence, there is help. Please call the National Domestic Violence Helpline at 1-800-799-7233. Or you can text SMART, that's S-M-A-R-T, to 88788. Okay, y'all, that officially brings us to the end of Chronicle 75. As always, be sure to check out my social media, where I always post photos associated with each case and episode. You can find me at Campus Crime Chronicles on both Facebook and Instagram. And y'all, I thought that I was going to be okay with going to a weekly podcast, but it has started to affect my health, both mental and physical health, and it's just too much while I still have a full-time job as, you know, a college administrator. So starting in April this month, I am going to go back to a bi-weekly podcast. However, I will still post a bonus chronicle every month to my Patreon. So if you just can't get enough of Campus Crime Chronicles and you are itching for a bonus episode every month besides just the two that I do, go check out my Patreon. You can find a direct link to my Patreon page on both my Facebook and my Instagram. So go check that out and bear with me as we plow forward through the year of 2024. Okay, y'all, well, that's all for today, so bye for now. Campus Crime Chronicles is researched, written, and recorded by me, Nicole Turner, and it's edited and produced by Giari Gassaway. Tune in again in 2 weeks for the next Chronicle.